You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Bob. Looking forward to our conversation.
So am I. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Jefferson Morley, a journalist, a veteran journalist, I think it's safe to say. You have worked on the staff of the Washington Post, the New Republic, other periodicals. You've written such books as The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton, Our Man in Mexico, Winston Scott and the Hidden History of the CIA, and CIA and JFK, The Secret Assassination Files. And you are the proprietor of the JFK Facts newsletter and the JFK Facts podcast. Now, and that all of this is pointing to what we're going to talk about, which is the JFK assassination. And you were on the podcast a little less than a year ago, and we talked about that. I encourage people to listen to that because we covered a fair amount of ground. And if they're wondering why we're talking about that again, there are several reasons. First of all, time flies. Yet another anniversary of the JFK assassination is upon us. Our last conversation was not long after the 60th anniversary. Right. Now we are at the 61st anniversary. He was killed on November 22nd. Second reason I want to talk about this. I went to a conference in Texas not long ago, and finally, I took the occasion to go to the assassination site. I've come back with some new impressions. I think I've cracked this case wide open, Jeff.
Somebody's got to do it, Bob.
You know, I know you've been at this a long time, but when I point out the thing you've overlooked, everything will be clear.
Okay.
I actually did come back with some impressions. Anyway, also, another reason to talk about this, for better or worse, Donald Trump has been elected president. And shortly before being elected, he said, I promise I will immediately release all remaining JFK files. One might ask, well, why didn't you do that when you were president the first time? Why didn't Biden do it? And the fact is that both of them, although nominally compelled to release more or less all the files by the JFK Records Act, both of them found a loophole, I would say, that you can characterize it as you wish, that that they used to keep thousands and thousands of documents still behind closed doors. The documents were supposed to be released as of, I think, 2017. They haven't been. Now, do you think, for starters, before we get into the assassination, do you think Trump will release a lot of files?
I think the chances are better this time. I mean, Trump's approach is to everything is transactional. So it depends on what he perceives his interests on the day when the question arrives in front of him. But because he made this promise on Joe Rogan and he joined forces with RFK Jr. and first made this promise back in August at a campaign rally with RFK Jr. So I think he's tied a little more tightly to his promise this time. So that gives me some hope. But, you know, like this experience shows, you know, with both Trump and Biden, you know, the institutional power of the CIA is quite impressive. And they showed the ability to get exactly what they wanted out of two very different presidents, Trump and Biden. So, you know, I just feel like the process can't be entrusted to the whims of a president. We need to, we need a law that will, you know, affect this and complete the job of full JFK disclosure. Now, you know, would Trump be amenable to that? Will Congress step in? I think that's the question that we in the JFK research community, people who are interested in the JFK presidency, are asking and wondering about. And, you know, I don't think we know. I mean, I was just watching a video of Kash Patel, who's tipped as the next CIA director. And he's saying, we want a 24/7 declassification office. He says, you know, give me JFK, give me 9/11. Mm. So he's looking for a kind of sweeping declassification, which I think is also a good idea. I mean, whatever other reservations we have about the Trump project, you know, the secrecy system really is broken. And the JFK Records Act has been nullified by the executive branch. And, you know, real radical reform is a good idea because way, way too much material is classified. And the JFK files, still secret after 61 years, that's kind of the crystallization or the epitome of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've done a lot of work in with this kind of material, lot of files that have been declassified. You did a lot of that for the Washington Post, and you've done a lot since. Do we have a very clear idea of what files remain? Because we should say a lot of files have been released as part, as a result of the JFK Records Act, right? And I guess some of them are significant. I don't know.
Yeah. So a couple of things. Do we know the documents that are being withheld? Yes, we do. There's probably about 3,400 JFK records that still contain redactions. Some of them, you know, a word, a name, others, you know, entire pages are withheld. So we do know about those records, but we also know about records that are assassination related that are not in the JFK collection at the National Archives now. And any serious declassification effort, any effort to really complete the work of the JFK Records Act requires another search of government files for JFK records known to exist that federal agencies have not turned over. So it's not just a matter of Trump writing an executive order, a new executive order, which would be appropriate, but a more systematic approach to really solve the problem and get all of the JFK records that are known to exist in the public record quickly.
Now, so go ahead.
So now, what's in those files? You know, Trump at one point told Andrew Napolitano, oh, if you'd seen what I'd seen in there, you wouldn't have released them either, you know, with the implication that like there was some explosive thing. In his latest appearance on Joe Rogan, Trump was much more circumspect. And he said, well, you know, maybe there's nothing in there. So, you know, I don't think he knows. I don't think that, you know, there's not one piece of evidence that says, you know, here's who's responsible for the assassination. But there are key pieces that are left over. I think the important thing for people to remember is we need to understand what we have gotten, you know, and I think people like me have emphasized, you know, what's still being kept secret. But I'm now turning more to, if we understand what we have learned in the last 10, 15 years, the assassination story is very different. And any honest accounting of the new evidence that has come into the record, you know, it shows that the official story of the lone gunman, quote unquote, is simply not true. I mean, it's fundamentally false. And what we understand from what has been declassified. And let me take one specific example. The CIA's pre-assassination file on Lee Harvey Oswald, the supposed assassin, the supposed lone gunman, okay? The CIA told the Warren Commission under oath, both Director John McCone and Deputy Director Richard Helms, that the CIA didn't know much about Oswald. McCone had an elaborate statement. We never contacted him. We never had anything to do with him in any way whatsoever. Richard Helms said under oath, when asked what kind of information the CIA had, he said it was probably minimal. Okay. Both of those statements are false.
And they knew them to be false?
McCone might not have known because he was an outsider to the CIA. He was a businessman, a Republican, who Kennedy had brought in there for kind of cover after the disaster of the Bay of Pigs. So he was totally dependent on his information for Helms. Helms was responsible, and he surely knew, or that statement probably minimal. And it's an interesting qualification because by saying probably, Helms actually, you know, exonerated himself from perjury. That modifier meant that his statement was not quite perjury. So yes, I think Helms definitely knew. In fact, the CIA had 42 documents on Oswald, 180 pages of material on him. They had his current address. They wherever he had gone for the previous 4 years, the CIA knew where he was. In that period, five that we know of, five codenamed covert CIA covert operations collected intelligence on Oswald. Five of them. Lingual, which intercepted Oswald's mail while he was in the Soviet Union. AmSanta was an infiltration operation of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, where the CIA learned of his contact with that organization. AmSpell funded Oswald's antagonists among the Cuban exiles in New Orleans. Lee Envoy was a wiretapping program in Mexico City that picked up on Oswald's conversations there. Lee Empty was a photographic surveillance operation in Mexico City, which took his picture. Five codenamed operations known only to a handful of people. And if you take all five, the number of people in the CIA who knew about all five of those is probably Dick Helms and Jim Angleton. They're the only ones who knew about all of the covert operations involving Oswald before the assassination. So now, if you imagine, so the story of a lone gunman is literally a cover story put on top of that reality to say, we didn't know anything about this guy. So pay no attention to the reality underneath, that we knew all about this guy. We had very detailed information on him 1 week before the assassination. Okay. Jane Roman, top assistant to James Angleton, signs for a FBI report that Oswald has gone to Mexico City, returned to Texas, and is there. And Jane Roman, Angleton's trusted assistant for a decade, initials that document on November 14th. So at that point, James Angleton, the top, one of the top men in the CIA, is looking at 180 pages on this obscure character named Lee Harvey Oswald, who 8 days later will be arrested for shooting the president. Now, that story that I've just told you, that is now a fact, but we don't have, you know, our academic historians, our journalists have not really come to look at the body of information and say, what does it tell us? Okay. What it tells us is the story of the lone gunman. I mean, let's just...
Okay, I want to give you a form of pushback on that point, but first let's do two other things quickly. So am I right in understanding that if Trump fulfilled your wildest dreams and did all he could do in accordance with the JFK Records Act, he would both unredact some documents we've seen the redacted versions of and release documents we haven't even seen?
The question of whether there's documents that have been withheld in full is very hard to determine because of all the secrecy that surrounds this. Of those 3,400 documents that we know about in the JFK collection, none of those are withheld in full. All of those, we have some portion of the
documents. Okay, so it's redaction that you know for sure you would like to see.
Yeah.
Another kind of a background question, but before I give you the aforementioned pushback, On the CIA, let me just put my cards out there. I had never paid any attention to this whole question until a year ago when the publicity surrounding the 60th anniversary kind of materialized. And I got to say, as we established, I think last time we talked, there's just a ton of weird stuff. I mean, you know, it's like everywhere you look, there's reason to be suspicious of the official story, and yet it's not that easy to confidently come up with a theory about what did happen. One of the reasons for suspicion, I think, unless I'm mistaken, is a story you helped break at the Washington Post. Are you the one who established that the CIA liaison to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the mid-70s was like kind of conveniently chosen? Like, so this is the second. So you've got the Warren Commission right after the assassination. And there's a lot of reason to be skeptical of that. And then I think this is in the wake of the Zapruder film of the assassination finally becoming public, being shown on national TV in the mid-70s, that they established a House Select Committee on Assassinations. And then tell us the story. But I guess, did you break this for the Washington Post?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. No. Actually, I broke the story, but the Washington Post wouldn't publish it.
Were you at the Post?
I was at the Post. I pitched it to them. A lot of people agreed with me that this was a very good story, but I couldn't get editors to sign off on it. And we can talk about, I want to get to your pushback, but we can talk about what happened to that story inside the Washington Post. But yes, I did break that story. And the story is this, and it's related to what I was saying.
And where was it published finally? Where did you publish it?
I first published it in the Miami New Times, and then I've been writing about it in my JFK Facts Substack.
Okay.
So the story is this. So in 1963, I referenced the five covert operations that touched on Oswald. One of those was called AMSPEL. AMSPEL was a secret operation to fund the Cuban Student Directorate. These were kind of the leading young people who were opposed to the Castro government. They'd come out of Havana because of repression, came to Miami in 1960, and were picked up and funded by the CIA under this program, AMSPEL. So in the summer of 1963, the Cuban Student Directorate delegation in New Orleans was one of the local organizations that this group had, both in North and South America. So Oswald attempts to infiltrate that organization. He goes into a store owned by the leading delegate and offers his services as a military advisor. He's been in the Marines. He gives the Cubans his Marine Corps manual. He says, I can help, you know, teach you how to blow up bridges and stuff. The Cubans are like, you know, go away. You know, they didn't really trust him. And 4 days later, they see him handing out pro-Castro pamphlets on the street. So they confront him on his double dealing. And there's a fight, and policemen come along and they break it up, and Oswald and the Cubans are arrested. Okay, so Oswald has come to the attention of the AMSPEL organization. Well, mm-hmm. AMSPEL was controlled by an officer in Miami named George Ioannidis. He was a career CIA officer who Helms had brought into Miami to run the group starting in December 1962. And so Ioannidis was running the group at the time of their contacts with Oswald. During this time, they had repeated contact with Oswald. They got into the fight with him. When Oswald appeared in court a few days later, the Cubans confronted him, and there were four CIA agents in that courtroom as part of the confrontation with Oswald. So, but the curious thing is, George Ioannidis never reported on these events at the time. And we know that CIA officers who handled that group always filed monthly progress reports. It's kind of the bureaucracy of espionage. Mm-hmm. These reports were, you know, how much money did we give them? What did they do with it? Were they effective? Is that supporting U.S. policy? You know, what do we do next time? So in the time that Ioannidis was handling the group, he never filed any reports. The case officers before him filed them, and the case officers after him filed those reports. Ioannidis filed no reports. The Warren Commission was never told that the CIA had funded Oswald's antagonists in New Orleans, and it never came up. The CIA mm-hmm. didn't know that any of this. I mean, the Warren Commission didn't know any of this. So fast forward 15 years later, like you say, the Zapruder film is shown on national TV for the first time in March 1975. Creates a storm of outrage. Nobody had seen this before. And the shocking pictures of the president getting, fatally wounded. And it appears by a shot from the front. His head goes flying back.
I'm gonna get into that when I unveil my fresh evidence from the scene of the crime, Jeff.
Yes,
we're gonna
okay.
get into
so,
that. Don't worry.
So Congress reopens the investigation. The Church Committee investigates, but the Church Committee doesn't want to reinvestigate the Kennedy assassination. They want to talk about the intelligence community as a whole. And there's mm-hmm. a whole bunch of abuses of power, assassination operations, mind control, domestic surveillance. So the Church Committee has a much bigger thing. And what they say is, we'll do a specific JFK investigation and the House will do that. So the House of Representatives creates the House Select Committee on Assassinations to look into JFK and Martin Luther King assassination. Mm-hmm. So now, by this time, there's a lot of skepticism. The Congress and the public realize they've been badly fooled by the CIA. The CIA lied about the Castro assassination plots, never disclosed them to the Warren Commission. They lied about how much they knew about Oswald before the assassination. And so a new investigation is started with a much more skeptical attitude of, you know, we're going to try and get to the bottom of this. So the House Select Committee is headed by a guy named Bob Blakey. He's had been a federal prosecutor in the Justice Department, organized crime specialty, the guy who wrote the RICO statutes. So, you know, an expert in conspiracy law. I think that's why they picked him. And they start going to the CIA and asking some tough questions. And it's at that time that the CIA calls out of retirement the self-same George Ioannidis and has him to be the liaison with the investigators. So the House investigators are coming to Ioannidis and saying, you know, we want to talk to this guy, we want to talk to that guy, we want to see this file, we want to see that file. And so Ioannidis is supposed to help them do that, right? This is the U.S. government cooperating to get to the bottom of the assassination, supposedly. So one of the questions that the House investigators have is, so who was running those Cuban students who were all over Oswald before the assassination? Like, you know, that we want to know more about what was going on there. And so they asked.
And they were looking at the answer.
They were looking at the answer, and they had no idea. Dan Hardway, who is a lawyer in West Virginia now, told me the story, and Bob Blakey also told me the story. They were looking at the answer, and Ioannidis said to them, he said, I don't know. I'll get back to you. And he never did.
And then so, you broke the story that, in fact, they had been looking at the answer? I mean, you're the one who revealed that this was the same guy. The guy they were asking who had been running this operation was the guy who had been running the operation.
Exactly. That had never been.
That's an important story. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on the Washington Post editorial judgment circa, you know, 1990s when you broke the story. But.
So let me tell you what happened, Bob, because it's very interesting about kind of, and this is relevant to today's discussion, sort of elite media attitudes about conspiracy theories and all that. So I came to the story. I showed it because, you know, in Washington Post News is a very collegial place, right? And if you've got a big story, I wasn't on the national staff. If you've got a story, you know, you need some backers because, you know, there's going to be a big discussion and people are going to look around and who's, you know, who thinks what. And that's the way the place worked. So I thought I'll go to Bob Woodward, who I knew slightly from, you know, amiable conversation around the office. I wouldn't say I was his friend. He was a friendly acquaintance. We would talk about Watergate and stuff like that once in a while, kind of like, you know, dugout chatter in a baseball game. But at this time I went to him and I said, look, here's the story. There's this guy. The CIA lied to the House Select Committee. They had a financial relationship with Oswald's antagonists. And, you know, we never knew this before. And Woodward said, you know, this meets my threshold for a story in two ways. One, you have an official on the record, Bob Blakey, and you have a financial relationship, you know, that's also verified. So he thought those two pillars of the story were very strong. So I took it to another senior editor, the investigations editor, and he said, well, yeah, this is very interesting, Jeff. Who killed Kennedy? What does this tell us about who killed Kennedy? And I said, I don't know who killed Kennedy. That's way beyond the scope of this article. And he said, well, what's your theory? I said, what's my theory? You want me to have a conspiracy theory when I come and deliver a hardcore piece of news reporting to you? Why are you asking me for a conspiracy theory?
I think he wanted you to not have one, right? I mean, if you was he concerned that you were a crazy conspiracy theorist or what?
I mean, he obviously knew that I wasn't because I had a very well-reported story that didn't have an ounce of the word conspiracy never appeared in it. So, you know, he didn't know what to do, right? So he was trying to figure out a reason, how do I get rid of this story? And I said, I don't have a conspiracy theory. We said, well, Jeff, the bar is very high on this story. So I said, yeah, okay. So the bar is very high, but we have two things that take us over the bar. We have a former senior official on the record, and we have a documented financial relationship. We're over the bar. And he said, the bar is very high on this story. And, you know, that was it.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Do you think he had been talking to higher ups or that was just his independent judgment?
You know, I think he probably consulted with other people. And I think, you know, there was a consensus that a story raising doubts about the CIA's performance was essentially a conspiracy theory, whether I was stating it or not. So to me, I think they thought I was smuggling my conspiracy theory into the pages of the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. Whereas I said, where's the theory in this story? There is no theory. Where's the factual mistakes? There were no factual mistakes. And so, you know, I just had to leave it there.
Uh-huh. Okay, so let me give you the form of the modest form of pushback I alluded to. And it's really by way of clarifying something. I mean, I took you to be saying that strong evidence that all of this are new are and really probably still growing knowledge about how much the CIA knew about Oswald, how closely they had been tracking him. And I definitely want to get into some specific dimensions of that, that to me are pretty suggestive.
Right.
And that we didn't get into last time. I took you to be saying that this tells us that the lone gunman theory is a cover story. And I would actually like to distinguish, as I think I did last time, between the conspiracy question per se and the lone gunman question. So in other words, it's in principle possible that a faction in the CIA, and this is probably the most common form of this theory, is that not the whole CIA, but a faction within the CIA, possibly working with a faction within the Pentagon, was behind this. And you can imagine them having kind of put Oswald up to it, subtly encouraged him or directed him to, who knows. And they're not having been a second gunman, but they wanted him to take shots at Kennedy. Because remember, one part of the theory is, as you certainly know, is that one scenario is, well, they wanted to start a war with Cuba. And hence the things you were just mentioning about how convenient that now there's all this evidence that he has these pro-Castro leanings, some of the evidence gathered in New Orleans. And in fact, the CIA, one of the CIA-funded organizations, right after the assassination, went to the news media and said, do you know about his pro-Castro ties? Right?
And those were AMSPEL agents.
Right.
Those were the paid agents of George Ioannidis.
Right. But it's possible that all of this happened, and still, it was just Oswald. There wasn't a second shooter. And corresponding to this, so I'll let the record show, you're nodding your head. You're okay with this so far. The corresponding to this, there's kind of two whole bodies of evidence that are both independently fascinating. One surrounding the shooting, the autopsy. And again, wherever you look, there's just weird and suggestive stuff, I'm telling you. And then the other is the area you've done the most research in, with the CIA, the background of various people in government with documents and interviews. So anyway, let me get to what my little visit to Dealey Plaza, which touches on the question of the multiple shooter question. Okay.
Yeah.
So first of all, I don't know if you've seen this, but let's see. So this is, I bought in the gift store. You know, I went to there's this museum, the sixth floor museum, you know, in the, God knows you've been there, in the book depository. I bought a facsimile copy of the Dallas Times Herald, November 22nd. So this was the evening paper. Dallas Morning News, by the way, whose publisher was one Dealey, after whom Dealey Plaza is named. I don't think that's a weird fact. I just think that's a coincidence. But the Dallas Times Herald, so this is the evening paper. So this is just hours after the assassination. This comes off the presses. So this is a fresh report. And one thing I would say is, you know, for people who think there's a second shooter, the most commonly posited location was behind the fence above the grassy knoll. We'll come to that.
Yeah.
And some people who think there was a second shooter point to witnesses who have said they heard first one shot and then two shots in rapid succession. And the succession was too rapid for it to have been Oswald because he had a bolt action rifle. This also figures in the so-called single bullet theory.
Right.
You know, did he couldn't have fired. We'll get into that. But anyway, so on the side of multiple shooters are witnesses, including, I thought, a particularly credible guy named Sam Holland, I think you probably, you know, who knows his shit, was on the railroad bridge. And he said, it was like, he was one of the people who I think said that, and certainly said one of the second shots sounded like a different caliber rifle. So anyway, this, apparently the reporter who wrote this was not on the scene, but their photographer was on the scene. This is just hours afterwards. And here's, I'm reading from the story. Photographer Bob Jackson of the Times Herald heard one shot and then two more rapid shots. From his vantage point in an open convertible, the eighth car in the procession, and we should say, I think eighth car would mean he hadn't made the turn on to Elm Street. So the book depository was still in front of him, probably directly in front of him. And it goes on and says, the eighth car in the procession, Jackson saw two men peering from the building window on the fifth floor. They were looking directly above their heads. Jackson saw a rifle being drawn back into a sixth floor window. There's other testimony to that effect. The two guys in the fifth floor have testified, I think, that they heard shots above them. If I'm correct, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's just interesting that he heard something more like pop and then pop, pop. I mean, we don't know how fast, but that's interesting. Although then he's also saying that seems pretty strong evidence that somebody was shooting from the sixth floor. I mean, that's probably the reason he looked up there. He saw the stuff he saw.
Well, I mean, you know, Connolly sustains a gunshot in the back. There was clearly
The Texas governor who was in the front seat.
Yeah. So I think, yes, somebody was firing from behind.
And let me just say, if people want to develop enough skepticism to go down the rabbit hole, speaking of Connolly.
Yeah.
Go to YouTube, go to the Zapruder film, and it's easy to become suspicious. Here's all you have to do is know that, according to people on the Warren Commission and pretty much everyone who says there was only one shooter, it has to be the case that the first shot to hit Kennedy also hit Connolly. That's the so-called single bullet theory, right? And if you look at the Zapruder film, as soon as Kennedy comes from behind this highway sign, he's been shot. Everyone agrees on that. He starts clutching his neck. The headshot hasn't happened. Look at what John Connolly is doing at that point. John Connolly is turning around. He's heard the shot, apparently. He's looking at Kennedy. He hasn't been shot. I mean, at least he's not acting like a guy who's been shot.
Yeah, I mean, Bob, so, you know.
And by the way, Connolly said the single bullet theory was bullshit.
Everybody in that car, nobody in that car thought that the single bullet theory was accurate. John Connolly said, no, that's not what happened. Nellie Connolly, also a hunter like her husband, said that's not what happened. When Jackie Kennedy was told the single bullet theory, she said, that's not at all how I remember it. And Roy Kellerman, the Secret Service man sitting in the front seat, said that all of a sudden a flurry of shells came into the car. So is two shots a flurry? I don't think so. So nobody in the car thought that is what happened. You know, and you talk about the grassy knoll and credible witnesses. I think the most credible witness is the man who coined the term, Merriman Smith. He was the UPI reporter in one of the press cars. He heard the gunshots, right away knew what had happened. He was a World War II veteran, grabbed the phone. In the car, there was a radio telephone, called his office in Chicago and said shots were fired at the presidential motorcade. He hangs up the phone. The limousine takes off for Parkland Hospital. The press car follows him. They pull into Parkland. They take Connolly into trauma room two. They take the president into trauma room one to try and save their lives. Okay. Merriman Smith jumps out and he starts talking to Secret Service men. Okay. And about 25 minutes later, about an hour after the assassination, He calls in another story. Now he's got a story, like a full-length story. And midway through that story, he says that Secret Service men thought that it came from automatic gunfire. Automatic gunfire from...
That's a machine gun.
I'm just saying what
he said. Okay.
Said the Secret Service men told him. And that the shot had come from a grassy knoll to which policemen rushed. So it was Merriman Smith who coined the term, the grassy knoll, and he was quoting Secret Service officers on the scene who said that's where they thought the gunfire had come from. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when people say, oh, the grassy knoll, you know, you're going all grassy knoll on me, you're totally crazy. Mm-hmm. That flips the reality on its head. In fact, Merriman Smith, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting that day, quoting Secret Service men, law enforcement officials who were on the scene, is the one, that's how we talk about there were shots from the grassy knoll. Mm-hmm. So it's not some fantasy that somebody made up afterwards. A highly capable journalist reported within an hour of the assassination.
This leads to my second piece of evidence gathered at the scene of the crime, Jeff. And by the way, I hope we may get a chance later to talk about why everyone says the single bullet theory has to be the case if Oswald was the only shooter. It has to do with, again, with how much time Oswald had, how long it took to do the bolt action on the rifle. And they've done these tests. So the second piece of evidence is kind of both for and against the grassy knoll theory. And and I should say, by the way, I just happen, you know, this, I swear to God, I'm done with this shit, man. It can get so time consuming. This was my second trip down the rabbit hole after this last visit to Texas. I'm done. I don't have time. But yesterday, while still in the rabbit hole, I did look at this interview with really the only other, just about the only other piece of footage of the assassination. It's from the other side, from the Zapruder film. It's not clear at all, but the interview, there's a number of interviews, black and white interviews, conducted by this guy who wrote Rush to Judgment. I think Mark Lane is his name. Within years of the assassination of witnesses. They're very interesting. He interviewed this guy who took that film.
Orville Nix.
Nix. It's the Nix film. So he's close. He's just on the other. He's on the other side of the street on this other stretch of grass. Right. And he says, oh, I thought it came from the fence, the behind the fence. Then he says, do you still? And he says, well, no, people tell me there's evidence that came from the book depository. Of course, the two aren't mutually exclusive. But anyway, his testimony was, he says that at the time, I thought it came from the fence, and that's what people I knew. Okay, now, exhibit B, and the final piece of evidence I've gathered. So tell me if you think this means I'm too obsessive. But so I went and stood at exactly the point behind the fence where the guy thought to have been standing. Mm-hmm. And so I took this picture. I took a few pictures. I finally succeeded in getting a car. You can see the fence in the foreground. I'm showing Jeff my smartphone. Yeah. I finally succeeded in getting a car. That car is exactly over the X that marks the spot of the headshot. So somebody in the backseat of that car, like, is Kennedy. So look at the angle the bullet would have to come from. It is slightly more from the side than the front, I would say. And with respect to his head, it would have been even a little more so because his head was tilted a little to the left when he was shot. And I will say, I mean, one kind of pro multiple shooter, one maybe not so pro, 2 points I'd make. I went back and looked at the Zapruder film, and if you look at the direction of his movement, this gets back to what I cut you off, I kept you from saying, which is that when the Zapruder film was shown in the 70s, people were going, wait a second, I thought Oswald was behind him. His head goes to the back.
Right.
Now, if you, and of course, they came up with theories to explain that. Apparently, it's possible in principle. We talked about this last time. Could be some kind of spinal column reaction. Could be that the kind of exhaust, so to speak, coming out of the front of his head pushes his head back the way a jet engine might. But anyway, that's the one side story. But I would say if you look at the direction of his body, that his body moves, and you can watch this in slow motion, you know, you can slow down your YouTube video. And especially if you look at his shoulder, it is consistent with the picture I just showed you. I mean, it really is a little more to the side than to the back, I would say. Certainly as much to the side as to the back. So that part is consistent, and it does, you look at it and you're just like, man, that just looks like the shooter was front and to the right. It doesn't look like a jet effect, but anyway, who knows? I don't know.
No, I mean, you know, there's a couple of things that need saying here. One, so there's two theories, the neuromuscular reaction, right? Mm-hmm. Which is Kennedy's brain is torn apart by, and this sends a jolt through his system and his body just reacts spasmodically. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the second theory is the jet effect, that a bullet going into someone's head expels, replaces the flesh and bone, and that comes flying back and that goes out, and that's what causes his head to go back. So the bullet coming from behind. Okay. Two things. Okay. Both of these are theories that have never been proven. They are not evidence. Okay. We can't run an experiment where we shoot somebody in Dealey Plaza and see which way is their head going.
Now, I thought I read somewhere they did the experiment with sheep. Did they not? I mean, They did. I know Alvarez, his physicist, did the thing with like melons or something. And one time he got the effect, you know, he was hoping for. And the other time.
The only instance in which the theory was nominally proven. They tried Alvarez and some graduate students at University of California experimented with these different objects substituting. And there was one case where in one instance, one type of object, I think it was a melon, you know, recoiled and went back towards the source of the gunfire, not away. So, but in every other case, the object went in the direction of the.
What about the sheep heads? Is that like, did I misread? Did they not kill sheep in behalf of this? You're not aware. If you're not aware, nobody is. So
the experiments that Alvarez did not involve animals, as far as I know.
But the problem remains for me that if a bullet from the grass, if from this spot goes through his head, it should come out the left side, which apparently no bullet did. You know, an example of somebody who believes in the multiple shooter thing is the surgeon at the Dallas hospital who had the closest view of him, McClellan, Dr. McClellan, who said he was the first person who pointed out the other doctors just like, wait, there's a huge hole in the back of his head. Part of his brain is falling out. This is like, you know, and McClellan says his view is that should have. So the bullet came from the front, blew the back out. And he's McClellan says, and I just think he hasn't looked at this that closely. He says, I think it came from the fence behind the grassy knoll. Well, that's hard to believe because the trajectory of the bullet from that place is not toward the back of the head. It just isn't. And I don't know my physics well enough to completely rule out the possibility that somehow a bullet from that angle blows out the back right of the head, but seems unlikely. So, I mean, this is so characteristic of this whole thing. There are so many reasons to think the official story's not right, but you can't come up with a single simple story that's compelling.
So I mean, I don't have a theory. Mm-hmm. I can't explain the crime, but I can tell you that the evidence does not support the notion that Kennedy was killed by two shots fired from behind by Lee Harvey Oswald. That is basically impossible given the fact pattern that we have. And we have a bunch of data points that, you know, that we didn't even have in at the time of Oliver Stone's movie. You know, we've had the Dallas doctors now. You talked about Dr. McClellan, but the rest of those doctors got together in 2010, 2011 and talked about what they had seen. And they all agreed that Kennedy had been hit by at least one shot from the front. All of the doctors who tried to save his life. Now, people say, oh, well, you know, they didn't say that at the time. They changed their mind. They were influenced by conspiracy theorists. Give me a break, okay? Dr. McClellan was a very respected doctor. He was a mentor to generations of doctors at Parkland Hospital. One of the doctors who said that Kennedy had been hit from the front eventually left Dallas. And the reason he left Dallas was because he had received threatening phone calls from the FBI, telling him that he had to change his testimony that Kennedy had been hit from the front. And Dr. Kemp Clark wanted to get away from that. So later in life, these doctors got together, told their story, and they just didn't, you know, they didn't buy that Kennedy had been hit by two shots from behind. I mean, and they had seen him.
I was thinking one of the doctors at least was taking issue with McClellan and buying the official story. Am I wrong about that?
Yes. No, they did not entirely agree. There were seven of them. Some of them talked more than others.
Yeah. Okay.
They had taken different positions on over the years. But the consensus of that group was that Kennedy had been hit in a crossfire. You know, I talk about Merriman Smith. There were 21 law enforcement officers on the scene of the crime who went towards the grassy knoll because that's where they thought the gunfire came from. 21 law enforcement officers.
Yeah. So, by the way, I should say, in theory, you could be a little to the right of the vantage point I showed you. And so it could have come a little more from the front. But the further right you get, the less plausible it is for various reasons. The fence isn't that long, and pretty soon you're right in full view of the people on the railroad bridge. But
the the gunman could have been farther down the fence line, but still behind the trees. And I think that would change the angle that you're talking about.
Yeah, it would change it. I think it's hard to imagine the bullet traveling a straight path from there and going out the right rear of the head in any event. But anyway, there's a lot. There are other posited places. So anyway, that's my contribution to JFK research. And I'm sure my name will live on.
Yeah, well, you know, it helps to go there and try and understand the crime scene. And I think, you know, what your research shows you is what people understand, which is this notion that a shot came from the front, and that's ridiculous, and only an anti-American rumor monger, irresponsible conspiracy theorist would think otherwise. That's nonsense. That's propaganda. Okay. And it's important for people to understand, we were propagandized, you know, from the moment the assassination happened. The CIA started denying, we didn't know anything about this guy. On the day of the assassination, Birch O'Neill, who's a kind of one of Jim Angleton's henchmen, one of the guys who controlled the pre-assassination Oswald file, had a friend in the FBI. He was a former FBI agent, called him up on the afternoon of the 22nd and said, what do you have on this guy Oswald? And Birch O'Neill says, there's nothing in our files besides some State Department and FBI reports. Okay, like, we didn't know anything about the guy. That was a lie. That was the first lie that the CIA told. Okay, and right from the start, this question of what did we know about Oswald? We didn't know anything about him. And that's the line that was fed to the Warren Commission, six months later, in May 1964.
As I said last time, one can imagine relatively innocent explanations. I mean, it would go something like this, just for the record, people can judge. Yeah. It would go like this. Look, Oswald had tried to defect, apparently, to the Soviet Union. Naturally, they're keeping tabs on him when he comes back. Naturally, they're embarrassed if he killed the president, and they had been keeping tabs on him and didn't give us a heads up. So they try to cover it all. One can come up with explanations. I just want to point that out.
Yeah,
now,
No. And that's a good point. So I wanted to test that. Okay. Mm-hmm. I interviewed two of the officers whose names appear on the pre-assassination Oswald file. These are people who knew who Lee Harvey Oswald was 6 weeks before the assassination and who had looked over the 181 pages of information that the CIA had on this obscure nobody who nobody ever cared about. And why would the CIA ever pay attention to him?
Mm-hmm.
Neither of them offered the argument that you're offering. You know, we screwed up. They did not talk about that. And I remember talking to Bill Hood. Bill Hood was the chief of operations in the Western Hemisphere. I went to interview him at his house in Amagansett, New York. And I said, I showed him the cable that his name was on. And I said, you know, why is your name on this? And he was silent for a minute. He never offered we were all over him and we just didn't know. And God, you know, we're really sorry, Mrs. Kennedy. You know, we just missed him. He did not ever offer that. Mm-hmm. What he did was he treated it like he responded very carefully. And Jane Roman, the other person who did the same thing. She was a little more candid than Hood. They talked about Oswald as if he was a participant in a covert operation and they had to be very careful about what they disclosed. And that was right, because at the time I interviewed those people, I didn't know that there were five operations that had collected information on Oswald. You know, I was naive at that point. I thought that they might offer the answer that you're talking about. Gee, we just missed him. But they did not offer that. And the CIA has never offered that explanation itself. They have stuck with Helms and McCombs' false testimony that they didn't know anything about the guy.
Okay.
So,
Jeff, as you know, we generally do close to an hour of this for the public, this podcast. Then we go into overtime, which is available to non-zero members, that is to say paid subscribers, non-zero newsletter. I, of course, encourage you to become a member and hope you think you're supporting a worthy cause if you do. Before we do that, I want to say a couple of things. First of all, sure. Your newsletter and podcast, JFK Facts, people should check out, especially as we now enter a period when there may a lot of additional documents may come out. You in any event, continue to do original reporting and bring new people onto the podcast.
At JFK Facts on Substack, and also on the JFK Facts podcast.
Yeah.
So yeah, and we are heading into a time where, you know, Trump has committed himself to releasing these issues. They're going to do something, you know. Mm-hmm. So some new possibilities have opened up in terms of the record of the assassination. So we don't know what's going to happen, but we do know something's going to happen.
Okay. I also want to give people a sense for what we're going to talk about in overtime. I mean, first of all, I want to talk about the autopsy and just to give people a sense. I mean, I said, everywhere you look, there's weird stuff. Okay. Here's a couple of weird things that I think are uncontested. The guy who did the autopsy, the doctor who did the autopsy, you know, you take these notes during the autopsy, then you write up your report, and then you burn the notes. No, just kidding. You don't. But he did. He did. And when they asked him why, he said, well, they had Kennedy's blood on them. Like, what? Are you kidding? You know what I would do? I would go to eBay. Of course, eBay didn't exist. But the point is, so in other words, the document is 100 times as valuable as you thought, so you burn it. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. The other thing is, oh, as for Kennedy's brain, it's missing. It's missing. They lost the president's brain. Now, these are uncontested facts, okay? And I don't know what to make of them. And again, you can come up with these, innocent explanations. I'm just saying, everywhere you look, it gets weird. The other thing I want to talk about in overtime is get back to the CIA and the role of so-called CIA assets. That is to say, people aren't on the explicit payroll of the CIA, but have a close relationship with it, may benefit monetarily. And the guy I want to talk about is George de Morenshield, who seems to have been tasked with kind of becoming Oswald's friend and keeping an eye on him, and seems to have gotten, by his own account, big oil contracts with the help of the CIA or the U.S. government. He is a fascinating case. I want to talk about that.
Yes.
So, and then also there's like a recent piece you did that maybe, let me just mention the name of it so people can go to your newsletter and read it. I think it's, does this sound familiar? Whistleblower Cites explosive document.
Yes.
And describes the CIA's secret JFK archive. So that's at the JFK Facts newsletter. It's pretty recent. And, now we will go to overtime. I encourage people to join us in any event. Thanks for following us this far. Feel free to smash the like button.